The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. Today, we're excited to be speaking with Michael Lebowitz. He's the founder and CEO of digital advertising and marketing agency Big Spaceship. When Lebowitz started Big Spaceship back in 2000, it was the early days of digital as we know it today. 17 years later, the company boasts over 100 employees, two Harvard Business Review case studies, and high-profile clients like JetBlue or YouTube. While the work has evolved over the years, Lebowitz says he's always set out to create a place to work that was better than just a job, a place where people could come to make cool shit, collaborate, and be themselves, a company that is a canvas for the people that work there, as he puts it. Now a fixture of Brooklyn's Dumbo neighborhood, which has grown up as a tech hub around the company, Big Spaceship seems almost to be an icon of Brooklyn approach to business itself. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I heard that you prefer to drop the phrase digital agency recently when talking about Big Spaceship. I've heard you say that you're more of like a modern partner to brands. Tell me a little about what does that mean?
I guess what that means is, well, I should back up. What we say is we're a modern partner to ambitious brands, and that's partly a way of defining our offering and partly a way of inviting the kinds of clients that we'll work best with. We want ambitious clients. You know, the world has changed incredibly radically since I started the company, which is 17 and a half years ago now. And digital required singling out. It required you to say it. And I think at this point, we don't have a digital life and a real world life. We just have our lives and we live them comfortably and we navigate very seamlessly between them. And in the agency landscape, to single yourself out, to isolate the word digital, is almost to ignore the way people actually live their lives. It's sort of like if you're saying you're digital, you're probably not at this point. So we just we needed to reflect the fact that we are sort of native to the culture, and the culture is the way that people experience their lives, and we're native to people's behaviors individually. And the best way to say that was just we're a modern agency. We are an agency of right now.
Now that brings up an interesting point. Certainly today, that could be argued to be true, that there is no such thing as digital. But when you started, certainly in the pop culture and the media, digital was different. And you were distinguished from other agencies. Did you see yourself that way at the time? And how did you differentiate yourself from some of the other sort of pre-digital things like Razorfish or agency would have been around the same time? Like, what were you thinking when you started the company yourself?
Well, I was pretty naive when I started the company. It's a long time ago. It was a naive time, and then I was young and inexperienced. You know, I mean, you said it in the intro. I just wanted to make cool shit. And I thought very naively, but, you know, fortunately for me, it's worked out, that if we just made cool shit, that we would get business and we would be able to do it kind of in our own way, in our own world. But digital then was a silo and a pretty small one. We were fighting for crumbs off the table. And when something is in a silo, it allows you to do a lot of innovation. You know, the tyranny of the unlimited canvas, right? You have really nice margins to work within, and that lets you deeply explore what's going on inside of those margins. As digital has gone from being sort of a silo to being a layer of everything, that canvas has gotten infinitely larger, and there's much more big business and big money behind it, and so conservatism sets in. And part of what we're trying to do is sort of pull forward the best of that beautiful, innocent time, which was the sort of universal attitude of let's figure it out.
So what were you doing before that? Were you thinking digitally in college? Were you a hacker as a kid?
In a way, I was. I got the Mac 512 at home and was obsessed with Mac Paint and Mac Write and all of the really basic software. But I wrote my little papers in grade school. And did a lot of gaming and started to meet friends who figured out how you could hack the really lame copy protection on games and copy them. And then we got a modem, and it was a 2400 baud modem, so incredibly slow. But I experienced CompuServe for the first time, and this is still, you know, mid-grade school. And the idea of sharing information, sharing software. And then from there, I created my own bulletin board where people could call in, dial in using their modems and share information on my Mac. But it was a little bit silly and kid-like because I had one modem, so only one person could actually come in at a time. It was the reduction of CompuServe down to nothing. But I was playing with these kinds of things of connecting with people online in pure text-based environments. And
back then, long distance calls were like a big deal, right? It was almost like today's internet, but every area code like had its own, you know, version of a search engine or its own place to find games, right? It was sort of like this federated world, like the pre-internet world, right?
Yeah, well, that was one of the advantages of a CompuServe subscription was that you got a local number you could call because long distance was so incredibly expensive, and it could pull lots and lots of people together. I mean, it was, I don't remember the genesis of CompuServe versus AOL, but I think CompuServe predated it a little bit, and then AOL was the one that kind of took things a lot further in that they were creating kind of the walled garden internet because it was required at that point. You didn't even have web browsers at that point, so they kind of created the first access points for a networked world.
So you were a prototypical hacker of sorts. Was Big Spaceship your first business? Did you have a business before that?
I never had a business before it. I did some work, again, really young. I think in summer after eighth grade, I was a tester for Bank Street Software that made classic programs like the Bank Street Writer and the Bank Street Speller.
I remember vividly.
Yeah, incredible. And they were published by Broderbund, who produced some of the best games.
Their strange Scandinavian spellings.
Yes, exactly. So I did that, and I did a little bit of coding, although I was never a very good coder in some other circumstances. And I think that kind of lit a fire in that I like to create. But beyond that, I was never particularly entrepreneurial until I had this idea that I could start a company that did what Big Spaceship does.
So what's the first day like? When you have that idea, are you what's the first phone call? Are you trying to reach out to a customer? Are you making business cards? Like, how do you start?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had an internship back at home. I swallowed my pride post college and moved back in with my mom so I could take an unpaid internship learning how to make websites, which lasted a couple of months, and I learned a lot very, very quickly. And it turned into a paid entry-level gig. And then I moved back to New York and got my first agency gig from 97 to 2000 when I started the company. And as we left, I had an original business partner who hasn't been with the business in quite some time. And as we left the old company, they gave us basically a project. There was a little quid pro quo involved, but they gave us our first project. So our first day of business, we had work to do, and we spent many months working on it. It was trying to simplify New York commercial real estate, which was an ambitious thing for two guys in an extra bedroom on Smith Street to take on. But it was really interesting, and it kind of seeded us and gave us money. I don't think we had given a ton of thought to business development, which is probably the height of our many acts of hubris and naivete from that time. But we did start pursuing clients sort of soon afterwards.
Right. When did you first feel like you were actually onto something with it?
I think the very first client that we pursued and won was Miramax Films. and we did a really interesting site for them, and it went very well. And right after that site, which was sort of a multi-film site for marketing for the Academy Awards, so it was much more sort of like online DVD extras, which at that time was very novel. Then they offered us the website for Bridget Jones's Diary. And every movie website at that time was just hierarchical information. Here are the press notes, here's the synopsis, here are the actor bios, maybe some AOL Instant Messenger icons. And we took a very different approach, which was to bring concept to it and add sort of thematic elements. So we sort of pictured the site, we put the user of the site in the position of being Bridget Jones watching the site, which is very meta, but you would watch, you would see one of the characters' photos come up on screen, and suddenly there would be little doodles marking, drawing an evil guy mustache on Mark Darcy's character. Is that his name, Mark Darcy? It's been a long time.
I don't remember.
We were the kings of the romantic comedy for a while. But anyways, it was a conceptual thing, and then we got another site, which right afterwards from Miramax, because that one had gone so well, for another romantic comedy called Serendipity with Kate Beckinsale and John Cusack. It's actually a project that I still reference to this day. I'm very proud of it because it was very much ahead of its time. It had no traditional navigation at all, and it was actually kind of an early stab at social media. We were trying to connect people online and find a way of getting you to your soulmate, which was the whole theme of the film, by the way that you randomly traveled through the site and opinions you expressed. And I think after that one got a ton of attention. You know, we had millions of people going through to figure out who their soulmate was. I mean, it was just, you would see a point on the map. We started with the map of the United States because it was a U.S. campaign. And if we were matched up, I would see your dot on the U.S. map in, say, Tulsa, Oklahoma, first name, last initial, and then you would see yours. But there was a real person there, and I think that was very captivating to people because that's incredibly commonplace now, but then it was unique. And I think once we saw the success of it, and there were people all over the world putting their dots in the middle of the, you know, Atlantic Ocean, I had a real sense that we could create things that were sort of elevated in their own right, that there was something of value above just being promotional, that it could be an experience unto itself. And that really guided us through... right through till now, although it's a very different environment now.
Now, what you're describing back then, I think at the time, was called like a web shop or interactive. You know, it was interactive media, and interactive was different from, you know, traditional media or print media or something like that. Right. So the services back then would have been really like creating a website. That would be sort of the fundamental part. And there's different parts of that that might involve, say, telling a story or trying to come up with a narrative or a visual theme. But, you know, websites were the core of services. That's not really true for you guys anymore, right? Tell me about how the services, you know, have evolved since then.
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't true. Definitely websites were the lingua franca of the internet. Once browsers took off, once Netscape and IE, curse them, you know, got sort of general penetration into the marketplace. So we made websites because the web was wired around pages. With the emergence of social, the web rewired itself around people. And so pages have diminished in prominence in most cases, but not in all cases. The counter to that is that when people do visit pages, those pages are often of critical business importance to the companies that own them. E-commerce and customer service and a lot of utilities and services that are offered by the large clients we have now, those are not promotional exercises. Those are businesses and have profit centers of their own built in.
Our infrastructure, right?
Exactly.
World's infrastructure.
Exactly. So I think where the experiential website has probably diminished quite a bit. And that's really what we cut our teeth on early on in the first 5 or 6 years. They still exist. We're actually building one right now. But for the most part, what we're building now when it comes to things that will be shown through a browser, whether mobile or desktop, are complex design systems. So we'll be working on whether it's an e-commerce site or wayfinding, interactive kiosks at retail, things like that that actually provide a lot of value and have a tremendous amount of deep user experience research attached to it, rather than an exploratory environment that's much more based in storytelling.
So that's an interesting contrast. Do you see yourself as, in some ways, an extension of the traditional advertising industry? I mean, are you a 30 years later version of Don Draper? Are you part of the same business? Are you solving the same problems for companies, or is it different?
I think there's a seed of something there. I didn't even realize we were in or adjacent to the advertising industry until we were about 7 years old as a company. We were just, you know, we were off in Dumbo, and nobody else was off in Dumbo. And all of our clients at that point were the Hollywood studios, so they were all on the West Coast other than Miramax. So we were kind of this weird petri dish. We were just kind of on our own, and we grew up our way. I mean, certainly we're part of the advertising industry, but part of our offering and what we sort of more pragmatic from a modern partner to ambitious brands is our philosophy on what a modern brand is, which is a combination of stories, systems, and communities. And how we go to market and what our skill sets are in having a fluency that lets us navigate between those things with equal agility, equal fluency. So we can create ads in the sense that we're telling video-based stories all the time. We always have multiple shoots going on, but we're also JetBlue's digital design partner, where we work with them on all things related to the passenger flight experience from booking all the way through. Those require very, very different skill sets. But for a brand, it's our belief that for a brand to be truly successful, you have to have your systems, your stories, and your communities all in harmony. And that's why our offering is in the sort of overlaps between those things. So if we're designing a system, we need to also be considering how stories flow in and out of that system, how communities embrace and take action, and how that emerges out into the culture from those systems. And it's the interworking of those things. So I'm taking a long way around to answer your question, but I don't think that there are a lot of agencies that think quite like that, which I'm happy about. But there's certainly an overlap in some of the outputs.
In a lot of ways, what you're trying to accomplish is a moving target too, right? Now you talk about your emergence came from this incredible phase change, or sea change rather, in consumer behavior. I mean, there was no internet, and then there was an internet, and then there was a commercial internet. Those are sort of these big landmarks. But there's, in some ways, it could be argued that there's been changes since then that are even more impactful. The obvious one would be, you know, the change from a desktop experience to having a portable computer in your pocket 100% of the time. How do you see and react to trends like that?
Our approach is, what we say is, technology is part of the heart and soul of the company, but we've never focused on technology. What we focus on are the cultural and behavioral implications and changes that are brought about by shifts in technology. If you're going to be around for 17 years, you're going to get completely upended and disrupted multiple times over, and really giant tectonic shifts multiple times over, and then smaller, more incremental ones all the time, all along the way. So the iPhone emerges and really kicks off the modern mobile era. Everything changes. What our competitors tended to do was add a new silo called mobile. And those mobile silos were filled with really smart mobile thinkers The problem is that mobile isn't a silo, much like digital isn't a silo.
Precisely.
But things start out that way because you need to put margins around something new. But our approach was, let's think about the cultural and behavioral implications of this new device. What are the behavioral implications of a window on software, the removal of all the sort of artificial distancing metaphors like keyboard and mouse, gestural interface, replacing that. You know, what are the cultural implications of everybody being connected to everybody else all the time and sort of real-time connectivity? And let all of our different expertises, all of our different disciplines, as we call them in the company, think about that for themselves. So rather than, yeah, we can put you in touch with our mobile thinkers over here, it was, we're all going to become mobile thinkers together, but with our own unique aperture on what that means.
Now you're touching on something challenging. It's been said that arguably the hardest part of running an agency, you know, is the staff, is the team. I mean, in some ways that's, you know, you're a factory that produces an awesome staff and then sells it. What's it like being a boss and going from, you know, zero to, you know, say hundreds of employees?
I got to do it slowly enough, and it was by intention in a lot of ways. I've never thought of growth as a goal in and of itself. It's a side effect of all the other things happening the way you want them to. So it's been more incremental for me than for many companies. And I'm happy about that because it allowed me to kind of get used to it. I used to put sort of artificial limitations, like we're never going to get bigger than X. And then we would get close to that. I would say, oh no, that's really dumb. We've got to move it up to here. And it took me three or four times of that happening before I realized that the problem wasn't a number. The problem is, can you figure out how to build strong enough cultural foundations that it will withstand another, an addition of, you know, many new people. And that was probably the biggest learning, you know, moment of learning of the whole time running this place. My whole career was, you know, culture first. And now it sounds incredibly commonplace. Everybody talks about culture. Most of the time they are actually talking about amenities.
What is culture? What does company culture mean?
Company culture is... ideally, a good company culture is one of shared values, shared behaviors, and a set of shifting but consistent sort of shared rituals. Most importantly, it isn't owned. It's manifested out of the connections between people. So you can set down what your values are. We have four core values as a company. We live by them. They're not just the plaque you put on the wall that then and then forget about. Every single person in the company could recite them, and they are they're our operating system. You know, the agency business is, generally speaking, completely buffeted by outside forces. We don't have a ton of control over what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not creating a product and stamping out defects in the assembly line and then producing it. We're doing something different every time. And as you said, we're sort of selling the combination of different minds and the culture that kind of governs that connection. So the only thing that we can really hold on to that's a true anchor that can be unshifting is those values. So we really take it seriously. We put those stakes in the ground and we hold to them. And I think those are sort of the guardrails for culture. But beyond that, it's, you know, it's everything from the physical space to the types of encouragement, what you value in people's performance. You know, I met a new joiner yesterday, and the advice that I gave him was the advice that I give every chance I get, which is, you know, it doesn't matter how much I like you. The best thing, the biggest determiner of success at the company is if your team finds you indispensable. You know, that's an expression of how we operate, and we operate that way, and that becomes hopefully a sort of positively recombinant set of behaviors.
Has it been challenging to maintain that culture, to maintain those values as you've literally shifted like an entire generation in the office, most likely from Gen X, I guess, to millennials? How do you preserve continuity through something so massive?
Again, it's the values, it's how you hire, and just being a very sort of kind and embracing place. The first of our core values is take care of each other. You know, a certain kind of person responds to that very well, regardless of their generation. They want to be, you know, feel cared for. And it's not just we provide great amenities. Like, we'll never compete with Google and Facebook and all of the, you know, delivered to your desk shoe repair services that they offer. If you asked any given person from Big Spaceship what they value most, they would say the people and the culture. 99 times out of 100.
Do you feel like Brooklyn's a part of your culture? Do you feel like that's part of your DNA?
You know, the Brooklyn question is a tough one for me, because for most of the time I've been in business, I would say yes. But Brooklyn has become such a thing writ large. When we moved to Dumbo, there were tumbleweeds blowing by. There was nothing going on here. There were artists and artisans, and most of them were not just having their sort of artist lofts, but were also illegally living in them. And it was really interesting, but it was undiscovered and pretty run down. And now you can't throw a rock and not hit a digital business or even just an agency, traditional or otherwise.
In fact, your building on Main Street, right, is now home to multiple giant, I mean, there's got to be like hundreds of millions of dollars in agency billing going on, like in your one footprint, right?
Probably, I would guess. And then if you add the Empire Stores in, there's even more. And then the new Dumbo Heights buildings, there's even more. And it's become a hub. And I guess there's some small degree of pride in that. But
I was going to say, how does that feel?
It feels okay. I mean, I'm really pragmatic, and I don't need the sort of, I don't need to be the godfather. It raised our rent,
right?
Which is fine. We just moved into a beautiful new space, and we're really happy with it. But I would say Brooklyn, as it was when we started, incubated us. You know, we paid nothing when we first moved here. We probably couldn't have done it. The agency was founded as the entire bubble was bursting and the economy was crashing in 2000. And then, we were just about a year and a half old when September 11th happened. And that was another giant blow, obviously psychologically and culturally, but also economically. And Brooklyn really enabled us to be a business and kind of find our way through that. I think now that Brooklyn is sort of a global brand, and you see foreign tourists walking down the streets of Dumbo every single day, is that Brooklyn a part of our DNA? I would say we won't leave. We definitely won't leave. And I'm very proud of being a Brooklyn business. I've lived in Brooklyn. I lived in Manhattan 1 month of my entire time in New York City, which is well over 20 years. I've lived in Brooklyn since long before it was cool, and I'm personally very proud of that. Like, I really love it, and I find it very sort of deeply satisfying. But I think it has become a little bit, the idea of Brooklyn has gotten sort of far outside of the Brooklyn that I live in and that I feel so passionately about. So there's a little dissonance there, but there's a tremendous pride in being a Brooklyn business, and there's no chance that Big Spaceship would ever move to Manhattan. But we may end up having offices in other places, and so then what does that mean?
Right.
If we open up in Culver City or Portland, Oregon, or wherever it might be.
All the other Brooklyns.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That's kind of the problem.
Exactly. Well, great. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to From Day One, How Brooklyn Entrepreneurs Got Their Start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a news site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, to learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at at thebridgebk.com. That's THEBRIDGEBK.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigmund. The From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and the Ambulamps. Thanks for listening.